Welcome to CounselorAudioSource.net. Counselor Audio Source is a weekly podcast dedicated to the professional enhancement of practicing counselors, supervisors, and counselor educators. Look for us on the web at CounselorAudioSource.net. I'm Dr. Marty Gentius from Kent State University, and this week on Counselor Audio Source, Dr. Chadwick Royal interviews Dr. Peggy Whiting, both from North Carolina Central University, about grief counseling and crisis response.
Well, this is Dr. Chadwick Royal from North Carolina Central University, and with me I have Dr. Peggy Whiting, who is a professor here in the Department of Counselor Education at NCCU. I wish we could start off with you telling us a little bit about yourself.
Okay. As Dr. Royal said, I came here as a professor of school counseling in the fall of this year, and prior to that I had worked at two other institutions in counselor education, Winthrop University in South Carolina and Vanderbilt University in Tennessee. And I have a background in both mental health counseling and school counseling, both. I've done lots of outreach to schools, specifically in school crisis response plan, and have held on to a private practice over the years where I've targeted a population of individuals and families who are in grief situations.
Well, speaking of that particular area, the loss and grief, I know that you're teaching a class this semester here at NCCU in grief counseling. And I know the kind of the answer to this question, but I want you to just articulate it. Is there a certain need for education in this area, in grief counseling and loss?
I would say that it's been an overlooked area for many, many years. Back in the late 80s, when I first came into this field, there were four universities in the country who offered, at the graduate level, who offered a program that included work around this area. So you can just see from the numbers, and that included, incidentally, counseling programs, social work programs, psychology programs, and pastoral care situations.
All so, those, and there were only four?
Right, exactly. There were four at the time, and none of those happened to be a required course. So the best that you could hope for was that somebody would get an elective option, and normally it was a course on death and bereavement, which, as we know, is the prototype of loss and certainly informs our practice in the loss and grief area, but it's not the only kind of loss that people experience. So it's been only recently that we've begun to broaden that notion, which makes it much more of a client issue that people can understand and see in their own practices, whether it's in community agencies or in schools.
So, why do counselors need this particular topic?
Well, I think the need has always been there, but let's just look at some current perspectives that are happening in the world, because I think they bring home the immediate need for us to have training in this. The increase in school violence alone, just in the last decade, has been astounding. We've had incident after incident that has been nationally recognized, and many that have not made the national news, but tragic nonetheless. So we have more and more school counselors who are articulating a need for this. They're saying, oh, well, I get out here, and my principal and my other staff folks, particularly the faculty, they turn to me when something has happened, and I realize I really haven't had any training in this area. So you look at the increase in that. You look at another statistic, which is the changes that have occurred in just what we call the contemporary family. And those changes have, we see an increase in the divorce rate, we see an increase in same-sex parenting, we see an increase in blending families, all of those in cross-cultural families, biracial families, etc., and all of those are experiences of often stressful transition for children mm-hmm. that counselors are going to be working with those folks and need that. So that would be the second reason that I would say. And then a third context would just be the national events that have occurred, like September 11th, like the war, like terrorism, the increase in terrorism. Mm-hmm. And we're called upon to deal with those in a variety of contexts. So I think we're seeing more and more of an immediate situation. The AIDS crisis, for example, mm-hmm. you know, is another thing. So we have some really high press issues that are in the loss grief area, which counselors need to think through and have some advanced preparation in order mm-hmm. to respond.
Yeah. I heard one of the things that you said really stuck out to me is that counselors are often called upon to react when things happen, mm-hmm. and that's the time when some counselors, I guess, panic because they're kind of left, well, what do I do? What's my role here? And I think one of the things that, one of the things that you've done is kind of done some thinking about, well, what is it that counselors do need? And you've had to structure mm-hmm. those education experiences around that. Well, so what have you come up with? What would counselors, you know, the traditional counselor education program, what types of things do you try and cover? How do you structure your class? What are they learning?
Well, one of the things that I've noticed is that when you broaden the definition of loss, you increase the scope of what you're hoping to do within the course of a semester, which means that just by the breadth of what you're doing, one course is hard to cover. It's hard to cover everything in one course. And mm-hmm. I have found over 20 years of teaching a course in loss and grief within counselor education that the ideal way would be to really have two courses, to have one that focused on the foundational information that counselors would need to know, and then a second one that would focus on clinical best practice. Mm-hmm. What I have, I've had the opportunity to teach only one course, and so I've had to put those two things together, which mm-hmm. makes it a lot of material. But I want counselors to, for example, be able to recognize issues of loss. So you have to start with students with helping them, just sensitize them to what are we talking about and mm-hmm. what's the multiplicity of issues that we would deal with in this area. So they have to start there. Then they have to know something about, well, what is the experience that people have when they're in transition or when they're in change and when they're in crisis. Mm-hmm. So they have to know a little bit about crisis intervention. Mm-hmm. It's not the only thing that we need to know, but we need to have distinctions between crisis intervention and grief counseling and grief therapy, because we know that grief therapy is more specialized when we have an understanding that grief is going awry. So once students begin to see the issues, then they need to be able to assess, well, how do we know that grief is going down a path that we would presume to be healthy? Mm-hmm. And how would we know when there are risk factors that we would need to be able to assess and then follow with a different kind of intervention? Mm-hmm. So we're looking for recognition. We're looking for assessment of risk factors. And then we're looking for best practice with diverse clientele. So you want to know what are the factors that make an individual's experience and their adaptation to loss mm-hmm. unique. And you want to think a little bit about what best practice is in crisis intervention, in grief counseling, when grief is going down a less complicated path, and grief therapy when you have a targeted at-risk issue mm-hmm. that's going on. And we have a whole wealth of knowledge out there on this. It's not a body of knowledge that counselors normally run into unless they take a specialized course. Mm-hmm. But there's a whole wealth of information about different types of losses. For example, suicide, homicide has those kinds of situations have a very different impact from deaths of other kinds. National mm-hmm. catastrophe has issues all of its own that counselors would need to be aware of in today's world. So your scope is really wide in terms of what they want to know, but it's knowledge base about grief theory, about grief practice, about intervention that helps in on both an individual and a family and group. Level.
Mm-hmm. Do you structure your class based on those different areas?
Yes.
You have traditional activities you do, or?
Yes, I have a whole variety of activities. I have some wonderful supplemental materials that are DVDs, CDs, videotapes, video clips, interviews, those kinds of things that help bring the material alive, so that you're not just reading about the topic, but doing various things. They're wonderful, popular media types of things that you can use just to bring home a point within the area. One of the most challenging things with students is that our wider North American culture, which would cover most of the students that we would have in the continental United States, we are considered to be the most death-defying society in the world. So we have counselors come into us really scared of the topic, and they come from their own diverse backgrounds that have limited their avenues for talking this out or for thinking about this in a different way or bringing it out of the closet on the table or... and most of us have not been taught practices culturally that are necessarily helpful in recognition of grief. And so you have to start, when you teach a course like this, you have to start knowing that your audience already has some misguided information that you're trying to affect a change in that within the class. So I try to use a variety of things that might prompt them to think differently.
Sure. You mentioned a couple of things when you talked about the more the structure of the and the kind of best practice, those types of things. What's new in this area? What are some of those things that you might talk about?
Well, one of the newest things that is happening is our understanding of where are we headed with a client in grief? Because for years, grief theory has really evolved, and we used to believe that grief was not public, that it was intrapsychic, not intersocial. And we're finding, you know, we thought that grief was something that you were trying to detach from something or someone and let go and move on. I mean, those are the kinds of cliches we use in professional and personal context. So we've moved to understanding that resolution, and we don't even use that term anymore, we use reconciliation, is more about more about relocating the event of loss in one's broader life story. So it's not something you're trying to get over or you're not trying to get back to normal. You're trying to incorporate into one's narrative something that has happened that changes the personhood of the griever. And that's a new lens for us. Like, so we have today what's called narrative reconstruction as the most current best practice, which is all about how do we use interventions that help a person reauthor a resilient story for their own future of what has happened. It's very different from putting a positive spin on something or positive thinking. So that is really new in the area, and one of the things that we're finding is that expressive arts modalities, so photography and dance and writing and, you know, all different forms of body work and ways that prompt emotional responses help people resituate a grief experience within their narrative, and it's called narrative reconstruction, and that's mm-hmm. on the cutting edge of practice now. Another cutting edge kind of idea is the idea of what's called theoretically continuing bonds theory, and what that means is that we're not detaching. In fact, we're continuing a bond with someone or some place or something, even though it may change and relocate itself in our broader story. Mm-hmm. We're not trying to let go anymore. That's not our theory anymore.
Sound like good things. Well, the second thing that I wanted to mention about you, you talked about the diversity in the way that people respond, I think, in certain situations. What types of factors, diverse factors, influence the way we respond?
Several years ago, the National Hospice Foundation produced a teleconference on who we are and how we grieve. Mm-hmm. And every year they have these fantastic teleconferences, an annual event where they take a specialized topic and give a series of readings and a panel discussion that you mm-hmm. can key into on a certain topic. And they did a topic that had to do with diversity. And when we talk about diversity and grief, we're talking about everything from social factors like age, level of developmental functioning, gender, ethnicity, cultural factors, religious, spiritual practices and beliefs. Mm-hmm. And then we're also talking about a number of other factors like the absence or presence of social support. The literature clearly says that that's the number one mitigating factor with the stress of grief is mm-hmm. what kind of social support does a person have when it occurs for them, and that varies a lot mm-hmm. with different folks and different client populations. We have special needs categories of people that would put them at risk, for example, the elderly. So diversity by age, grief is very, very stressful, and so knowing what the baseline health situation is of the person that is in a grief situation is imperative, because it'll mm-hmm. change how they adapt and what your intervention would look like. Mm-hmm. We also find that another factor of diversity is the type of event that happens. All losses aren't in the same broad category of event. We have some losses that are anticipated, and we have time to think and plan mm-hmm. and close out and just accommodate what's happening to us, just adapt, just the time needed for that. And other losses don't afford us that. They catch us off guard. They're sudden, unexpected, often very catastrophic, untimely. If they have a sense of violence about them, those kinds of events are very different events. When you have events that affect masses of people, that has a different kind of impact. So those are also included when we talk about diversity. The type of event that one is experiencing mm-hmm. matters a lot in terms of what their experience is going to be. Mm-hmm. So all those factors, they're just a multitude of factors and a wealth of research and best practice literature available for us to talk about the ways an individual with their specific diversity characteristics and the type of event and all that mm-hmm. would, how their response manifests within that context.
Mm-hmm. So the individual and the event.
That's correct.
Okay. What type of professional organizations are out there for individuals that are interested in this type of counseling?
Well, the number one international organization is the Association for Death Education and Counseling. It's a well-known and very viable organization that produces the national credentialing for grief counseling and grief education. Mm-hmm. And they have a very specific program with a national certification exam similar to the NCE for counseling. Mm-hmm. They are historically rooted, I have found in my participation with this group, not in a counseling group. They came out primarily of hospice movements within the country. So there are many folks who are social workers within those contexts. Mm-hmm. Lots of end of life care providers. Mm-hmm. Lots of nurses. So more social work nurse oriented than counseling, even though counseling is in the name of the organization.
Mm-hmm.
So that's been a real interesting experience for me. I would like to see ADEC and ACA have much more interfacing and joint effort than mm-hmm. what I have seen historically. But ADEC is a marvelous organization, has countless amounts of resources available for counselors
mm-hmm.
On all the topics that we've already talked about. Mm-hmm. And they also always give a response to the current events. So, for example, there is a response with some links to appropriate resources. There's a response to what happened tragically at Virginia Tech yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
And you can click on the ADEC website, and it will take you to a whole wealth of information on that topic. The same was certainly true when September 11th or Columbine. I think mm-hmm. about Columbine because we're sitting on an anniversary in a couple of days mm-hmm. of that tragedy.
Yeah. Well, speaking of that, I'm glad you brought that up. That just want to acknowledge that we are recording this on Tuesday, April the 17th. The Virginia Tech shootings took place yesterday. And I was just curious about, because you've had experience with schools in particular responding to crises, what types of things do you think about, or what are brought up just by what you know about these recent shootings at Virginia Tech?
Well, we were all saddened to watch and are continuing to watch the press releases associated with this type of event. A couple of things come to mind just from a loss and grief standpoint. One is, when we talk about diversity by type of event, you have two things going on here. You have a situation of multiple loss, where it's not one death, it's multiple deaths mm-hmm. that have occurred in a small contained community atmosphere. So you have the special features that multiple loss brings, and one of those happens to be just the overwhelming feeling that people have of it's incomprehensible to take in how did 30 some odd people come to be murdered.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's an awesome statistic and situation to even take in. So a lot of the initial responses that we're seeing with folks who are under fire to give the press releases is just that they're overwhelmed and in shock, really, by what's occurred. And that's a natural, expected reaction to something that is a massive horror for people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's real different from some other kinds of losses that we have. So there's some very predictable responses. People are going to have a lot of unanswered questions. They're going to want their questions answered very, very quickly because it gives us a sense of greater control the more we know about what happened. There'll be lots of interest in who's responsible for this and are steps being taken to find out who that person or persons might be, and will they be prosecuted for what they've done?
Mm-hmm.
That's a very specific characteristic. Lots of rage and guilt are associated with these kinds of experiences. And it makes it unique. The amount of guilt and rage is unique in situations of this sort. There's a lack of privacy that occurs. The media is trying to do their job and expose the story, and it is their job to do that. But often their role collides with the roles and commitments of other people, like the police force, for example. They're running a criminal investigation right now, and certain facts can't be released
mm-hmm.
Because of the investigation, the ongoing investigation. The news people want the story. They want to be the first to have it. So you have, and then you have school personnel who are trying to represent liability issues for the school and try to give answers to the public in the middle of having their own response to students and staff and faculty being a part of those who were killed. So you have some very specific situations that come to mind when I watch an event like this unfold. There's also a real interesting thing is happening, which is very typical. This happened in Columbine and other kinds of in September 11th. While there is an obvious need for trained people to provide assistance to the campus, there is also the fear of opening the campus to any other outsiders. Mm-hmm. And that's a very typical reaction when the boundaries of a community have been violated mm-hmm. in this kind of way. So there's a reluctance to letting any more outside people come in. So often the assistance, the linkages with the people who could provide assistance, those links don't occur because people are fearful of mm-hmm. what that would involve. Mm-hmm. So I know, for example, that ADEC folks are willing and on alert to be brought in to be first responders or mm-hmm. Interveners in this situation, and yet there has to be a willingness and an openness for the community to have other folks there. Mm-hmm. And that's always a tricky kind of thing. Was in the Pennsylvania Amish shooting, was in Columbine, was in many national September 11th, et cetera. Mm-hmm. How do you monitor who's coming in and out, and how do you know that their credentials are what they need to be, and how do you know they're going to be helpful mm-hmm. in an already vulnerable, high-profile situation?
Yeah. Well, let's say that they are brought in, and any of the listeners might be called upon in a situation similar to this, possibly later on in their own career. How do counselors function in an arena like that?
Well, normally there needs to be, in an event of this magnitude, there needs to be a structured response. Like something that would add to the chaos would be for well-intended people who didn't have any background in offering crisis response, no specific training in that, to just show up and start mm-hmm. trying to be helpful. Mm-hmm. That could actually be more chaotic. And so what is really needed is that you have a team of people who work as a team, mm-hmm. and you have a bureaucratic structure within that of who's calling the shots, because there are lots of decisions that have to be made mm-hmm. about who is most impacted, mm-hmm. what kinds of services are we going to offer to them, where mm-hmm. are those environments. Where's the service going to occur? Mm-hmm. Do you have a secure, safe place for people to come? How do you link up the people who need the service and the people providing the service? How do you deal with the multiple levels of impact when you have a situation like on this campus at Virginia Tech? You have multiple levels of impact. There's some people who are very, very close to the situation. I think we will find in this story that there were other students and other personnel in the buildings where the shootings were happening. Mm-hmm. They made it out. Some other people didn't. So you have that kind of level of response, and all the way to parents and family and friends of folks who were students there or staff members there. They weren't on the campus experiencing the event, but they had the concern of being off campus. Mm-hmm. So you have multiple levels and layers of responses that need to occur, and you have to have sort of an organized structure of how you're going to offer that and for how long.
Yeah, that's what I was just thinking about. How do things differ between short-term and long-term?
Well, and one of the things that I have found in my 20 years of experience in this area is that we can be pretty good at offering, we meaning counselors, mm-hmm. can be pretty good at offering an initial response. Mm-hmm. With a little bit of training combined with what counselors already know and the sensitivities that we already have, mm-hmm. You can prepare people to come in and do an initial response. But what we're not very good at in the culture at large and in these situations is keeping the responses going over time, because you have intervention and you have postvention kinds of efforts that need to occur. The ideal way to operate is if an organization or a place, in this case, this particular university, if you have a crisis response plan already in place, that's really your best prevention. Then you can bring folks in if something does happen. That's your immediate intervention. And then you have some postvention efforts where you say, okay, we know that needs and responses are going to continue over time. This isn't going to be a quick fix thing. It never is. There are folks still receiving and needing services from 9/11. And we like to think that it closes up faster than it actually does for people. There's residue, even with folks who are grieving very well and are going along what we would clinically think is a healthy path of reconciliation, it takes much, much longer than our culture endorses or even understands and makes legitimate. And so counselors need to be aware of that, and I would hope that someone will, after the first few weeks of intervention occur, to address the immediate needs, that someone will converse, for example, with the administration at Virginia Tech and emphasize how important it is to provide ongoing service for people in a situation like this.
Well, I want to thank you for your time. Appreciate you, your willingness to spend some time chatting about this.
Absolutely.
You've just heard an interview of Dr. Peggy Whiting by Dr. Chadwick Royal, both from North Carolina Central University, about grief counseling and crisis response.
Look for previous podcasts, show notes, and listener feedback on the podcast website at counselorAudiosource.net. Listeners can leave comments or questions for our interview guests or hosts through our Skype.com internet telephone ID, Counselor Audio Source, or by calling 330-871-4242. Counseling techniques and interventions discussed in the Counselor Audio Source broadcast are meant for use by counseling professionals, and Counselor Audio Source is not held liable for any use of the techniques mentioned in the program. Our music bed today is Memorial Day from Jamie Beauchamp. His and other PodSafe music can be found in the PodSafe Music Network at podshow.com. Counselor Audio Source is licensed under the Creative Commons, a nonprofit organization offering a flexible copyright for creative work.